So tonight I want to give a talk. The title of it was The Three Pillars of Dhamma. And before I actually give the talk, I want to talk a little bit about how I came to this topic, or how I came to this particular form of this topic. I originally gave a talk, and I actually have the copy of the text for that talk and an article I wrote even long before that on this particular topic. And I taught it in a very sort of classic, traditional way. I mean, the idea, you know, the image of the three pillars, right? It's like these three pillars hold up the Dhamma. But when I was thinking about it more recently, and when I was thinking about giving this talk, I realized that I didn't think of the three pillars. You know, of course, the three pillars are dana, sila, and bhavana. You know, generosity, virtue, and practice. I didn't think of them as three separate pillars anymore. They didn't seem at all separate, which is how this is often taught. Like you sort of go through, here's what dana means, and here, you know, each of them gets defined in a sense. And so I was trying to come up with another image that suited me more than the three pillars. And I came up with the three aspen trunks of Dhamma. You know, aspen trees are an amazing thing. First of all, like, they're big, beautiful trees, right? But their root system, you know, in a grove of aspens, it's all one root system. All the trees are connected together. And then, if you look at a grove of aspens, up higher, the branches sort of start to interlace and interlock and bump into each other. They're very, very connected. And so I'd rather have my, maybe this is a Colorado thing, I don't know, with the aspens, but I want to think of this as, you know, the three aspen trunks of Dhamma or something like that. And I want to talk about this relationship between these three pillars, which are often taught as three separate things, because I think they're very deeply interconnected. And then, which is really, when I think about it a little more, it's like, but that's all of the Buddhist teachings are like that. You know, all of the Buddhist teachings are interconnected. It's not like, you know, you see all these lists because it's a convenient way to teach and remember. But when you start really looking at the lists and you see, oh, wait, but that's dependent on that, and that flows out of this, and it's a different way of thinking about things that I'm coming to more than more. So the first thing, as I mentioned, is dana. And the interesting thing with dana, you know, generosity, is whenever the Buddha taught, whenever the Buddha came to a new place, and the people there wanted him to teach, the first thing he always taught was dana. And you know, you could think of this, well, you know, he was making sure he got fed that day. I mean, you could think of it that way. But actually, when you think about dana, generosity, being generous, it's an attitude that anyone can have. You don't need any special qualifications to be generous. You know, you don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to be a man or a woman or whatever. It doesn't make any difference. Anybody, you don't have to be rich, you don't have to be, you know, or poor. Anybody can be generous. And so he was teaching something that everybody immediately could see, oh, I can practice that. It was like giving them a really easy way in a sense, but also something that was totally essential to how he taught and how his whole sangha operated. When you come to the West, when these teachings came to the West, dana turned into like a commercial transaction almost, right? And I've never been wildly comfortable with that, except that we all have to deal with that. And it's partly because our whole culture is based on the idea that we're defined by what we possess. I've got the cool car, or the nice house, or the good job, or the latest electronic doodad. And they're all mine. And in thinking that way, we create separateness from others. There's mine and not mine. Automatically, we're creating a sense of separation. And our self-image is propped up by the things we own or don't own. Like if we're poor, our self-image could be, I'm not very good. I don't look at all those people who have all that stuff and I don't have any of it. I must be not a good person. Right? And so basically I think generosity encourages us to start thinking of our possessions, of the things we need. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have possessions. We're all householders. We're not monastics. We need a bit more than a robe and a bowl and some medicine and a little hut to function in the world, in our the world of the society we're part of. But we need to start thinking about the things that we use to function in the world as not mine. Instead, just think of them as just stuff. Very technical poly term, I realize. It's just stuff. I have these things now because I need them to do what I'm doing. When I worked as a carpenter, I had lots of tools. I had to have those tools to do what I did to maintain life and do the jobs I was doing. So I had to have stuff. But it was like, people would want to borrow a tool or use this tool or that tool. Never bothered me. It's okay. But it's more like now that I don't do that work so much, I have less of those things. And I keep thinking, oh, do I really need this anymore? I just gave away a few months ago a whole collection of clamps that I had that I used to make furniture and stuff. I don't make furniture anymore, so gave all the clamps away. Because I don't need them, but someone else will probably thought, oh my God, look at these great clamps, right? When they went into Arc Thrift to find them there. And so we just shift these things that I have that I need, and if I don't need them more, then I just push them out into the world and let someone else have them. And now it's their stuff, they take care of that stuff for a while, and then they'll pass it on to someone else again. It's a fluid way of looking at possessions as opposed to them being mine. They're just something that I use now, and when I don't have any use for it, I pass it on. I think if we could all think in this way about the things we have, it would be much easier. The thing with generosity also is it's what's called a wholesome mind state. But the interesting thing about generosity is it generates three forms of wholesome mind state. Think about you're going to be generous, you're going to do something of a generous nature, whatever it is. There's the time before you actually do that generous thing where you have these wholesome thoughts about doing it. And then there's the actual act of doing it. And when you actually do it, it's always a very sweet, wholesome time. The actual act of giving always has a wholesomeness to it. It makes you feel good. It has a wholesomeness to it. And then afterwards, the next day or the next month or the next year, who knows? You think about it and you sort of have a little soft smile. Oh. Yeah, that felt really good. Felt really good. And I not in the way of like, oh, aren't I wonderful that I was so good? It's just like you remember the sweetness of the process of thinking about it and actually doing it. So generosity has this way of creating multiple forms of wholesome mind state just by the act of giving itself. But it's really important, you know, that we don't make this into like a fetishy sort of like how I'm supposed to give because that's what Buddhists do. You know, I got to be a good dana person, right? I got to give. It's because it's your the attitude you have as when you give is really important. It's like you don't need any need for praise. You don't expect anything in return. You're just giving. Just the simple letting go of something. And so, and the feelings, the energy, you know, if we give sort of begrudgingly, like, well, you know, these kids are coming around and I know that their parents and they're asking for some donation for something and I should, if there's a should, pop it into your brain, well, look at that. Instead of just, oh, great, I'll be happy to do this. Because the quality of the what we're giving is literally affected by the attitude we have when we give. There's a famous story. This is a, you know, in the Buddha's day, you know, all the monks would gather together for the rains retreat someplace, you know, the Deer Park, places like that. And, you know, there was a very famous banker who was a very devoted disciple of the Buddha's, and he would, every day that he could, he would get enough food made so that all the monks could come and be fed. And then he would just sit and watch, and the people who cooked the food would just sit and watch the monks eat, and it just made them so happy to see the monks eating the food. Just that their joy was just in seeing that the monks were fed and continued to practice. So the local king found out about this, and he's saying, well, you know, this guy's just a banker, I'm the king, right? So I should do this, you know. So he arranged to get his, you know, cooks together, and they were going to cook this fabulous food, and, you know, invited all the monks to come on a certain day to come and be fed by the king. And he wanted to make it like better than what that banker could do, right? Because he's the king, right? So all the monks come and they take the food and then they walk away. And so the king doesn't get to watch them eat the food, and which is like part of the whole traditional practice, right? And he can't figure out what's going on. And he gets upset, and then eventually he asks someone, and he says, oh, what the monks did is they took the food, and they went to some poor villager, and they gave the food to the poor villager. And then the villager gave it back to them. And then it was okay, because there wasn't the vibe of wanting praise and thinking how wonderful I am for giving. It changed the vibe of the food. It's interesting. It's an interesting story, I think, because it's like it points to how important it is that we have the right attitude, the right energy when we give, when we're generous. Another aspect of generosity, and one that we don't often talk about, is that we have to let other people give to us. It's so easy. Like someone offers you something, and you go, oh no, I don't need that. Thank you very much, but no, I don't need that. You just took away their opportunity to be generous and to feel the joy of their generosity. This is unwholesome. And it may be that you really don't want it. You think it's some, you know, hideous thing they're giving you, like some thing their kid made or something. Who knows, right? It's like you might not much think anything of it at all, or you don't need it. But you take it anyway. Just take it. Thank them for it. Let them feel the joy of their own generosity. And then, you know, if you really don't want it, need it, you can just give it away the next day. You don't have to keep it. It's not yours anyway, it's just passing through. And so it's like it's you become a conduit for generosity of other people in a sense. But you let people experience the joy of generosity without exception. And it's once again hard to do. Carol Wilson, who spent a lot of time in Myanmar with the monks and nuns there, tells a story about going someplace and giving to some really, really poor family, giving them something they needed. Oh, they were installing better toilets, you know, creating better sanitation. And so for this particular family compound, they actually brought in and installed this kind of, from the people's point of view, a pretty luxurious toilet, right? You know, very good sanitation, et cetera, et cetera. And they just gave it to these people. And the next day, the person, you know, one of the head people in that family came with this battered up old shovel and gave it to Carol. It was like they had to reciprocate. It was part of the culture that if someone's generous, I should be generous too. And so they gave, and Carol didn't need this shovel, let me tell you. But she just took it and thanked them. So it's a way of letting people be generous. And then the final thing I want to note is that often generosity has absolutely nothing to do with money or material goods at all. It has to do with our time. It has to do with being generous with their time. Doing things that the only reason we're doing them is because they need to be done. And someone isn't doing it and it needs to be done. Volunteering. And it's such a generous thing to do, to volunteer your time with no, because when you volunteer, really, it's like no expectation of praise or anything. You're just doing it because it needs to be done. Whether it's some small thing or some very larger thing, you just give your time to the community. And there's an infinite number of ways people can do that. There's never enough people volunteering, given all the things that need to be done. And it's just, we just do it out of generosity. I'm giving away my time. And we just take care of it that way. Now the thing about this, and now I'm getting a little closer to talking about how this is all these things are connected. The thing about all these things I just talked about is you have to actually remember to do them. You know, generosity is a practice. We think of it as some sort of static thing. It's not like a trunk of a tree. It's a living thing. And we have to keep being aware of opportunities to arise and then being generous. And this requires mindfulness. You know, this is mindfulness in the world. This is taking our mindfulness practice out into our day-to-day life and going and seeing opportunities. And it could be as simple as, you know, holding the door for someone who's coming right behind you, and you can see they're struggling, they got two packages, and that's a very generous act. It's really simple. But just doing some little thing like that, but being aware of it, like not just being in such a hurry that we don't see that, which is often the case, right? We just have to, being generous often requires that we slow down and look a little bit. Final thing I think, and this is also I think quite important, is generosity has to do with the fact that we come and practice together. Coming to practice with other people is an incredibly generous thing to do. It helps other people, it gives other people energy. The power of Sangha is basically generosity in action. We're here not sitting in our little room all by ourselves where no one knows. We're here practicing together because it encourages each other to keep practicing. It's really that simple. It's an incredibly generous thing to do, to go practice with other people on a regular basis or whenever you can. Once again, it takes mindfulness to do that. You have to go, oh yeah, it's Thursday night, 7 o'clock. You know, they want me to go to the movies, instead I'm gonna go hang out with Barry. Or whatever it is you're doing, right? It's a practice. It's like anything else. So that's generosity. You know, dana. And then sila. Sila, I like the translation of sila as virtue. Virtue is sort of an old-fashioned word, right? You don't hear a lot of people talking about virtue anymore. But I like it because I see it as virtue is quite distinct from morality. You know, virtue is this idea of intelligently following certain guidelines that will lead us, make our lives more conducive to practice. Really, that's what it is. It's like if we live a virtuous life, then our mind will be calmer, and when we go to actually sit and practice, the mind will stay calmer. But virtue is like pointing us in that direction. Here's things you could look at in your life. And if you really feel into them, if you're very mindful as you live your day-to-day life, you can live a life of virtue and enjoy what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. I love that phrase. Morality is different. Morality is sort of like this set of rules again, but it's rules. You know, do this or else. There's sort of wagging finger attached to morality. And there's a whole layer of you must follow this. So virtue is sort of like a finger, go this way, right? And morality is no, don't do that or do this, or it's a different, the finger's doing a different thing, it's pointing in a different way. And of course, you know, sila is defined in the Buddhist tradition with the five precepts, which I'm going to just very briefly go over because I know you all know these, but, you know, so it's like, you know, not harming, taking only what is offered, not using wrong speech, refraining from sexual misconduct, and not abusing intoxicants. And these, we can look at, even these, they sound like five separate things, but they're all very interrelated. Right. So take non-harming. You know, you see this sometimes, the translation is not killing. Yeah, so you don't kill people, don't, you know, and then you take that a little bit further and it becomes not killing animals for food, and you know, so where veganism quickly arises. But I think that non-harming is a much larger field. And you can look at everything in your life, everything you do, and all the choices you make in the sense of, is this harming others? Is this causing harm in the world? You know, and that's a tricky place because, you know, we like how things are, and I don't want to have to think about this stuff. Yeah. But, you know, I can, you know, this is the whole world, it's the whole world of what's called engaged Buddhism that's risen very, especially strongly in the West, where this has become, this is a huge area of conversation in the Buddhist world, where people are discussing, you know, this with environmental issues, with health issues, with all kinds of different issues of that sort, where you go, oh, wait, am I harming the environment by doing this? Because if I harm the environment, I'm harming others, because others live in the same environment. And once again, there's the balance we have to take between, yeah, well, I got to function in the world. And there's sort of that's a tricky place, right? And so, but it means that we have to be mindful all the time when we choose to do things or not do things. Is it based on, am I harming others? This requires us to be mindful all the time, to pay attention. So the next one, you know, taking only what is offered, obviously means not stealing. Right? But once again, especially as because we're householders and we have stuff, as I mentioned, we use stuff, then we have to look at, do I have too much stuff? Do I have more than I really need? Am I, because everything I have had to be produced, and a lot of the means of production aren't particularly good for the environment. And so if I have too much stuff, am I causing harm? See, and all of a sudden here we are relating the first two, just like that. And also just like, if I have more stuff, maybe some other people have less because I have more. Can I reduce my stuff level? I mentioned that when I worked doing carpentry, I actually had six different saws, six different power saws. But I actually, each of them had their own specific use, and at various times I needed all six of them. But I knew guys I worked with would have two or three of each, because they'd find a better one and they'd better keep, and it's like they just couldn't resist having, you know, I would have to, like, you know, walk through the tool department at McGuckin's Hardware and sort of go like this, you know, oh no, I'm not gonna look, like, you know, it was like, oh my god, look at all those great tools. And but some guys couldn't handle that at all. They had to have more than one of everything just in case something broke, you know. And it's like they just had so much stuff, and it's like, it's this conscious choice. I'm going to have one of them. I need this. And then eventually one of my table saw broke, and I just didn't get another table saw because I didn't need one anymore, and so on. And that's how I'm gradually getting rid of things, because I wear them out and I just don't replace them because I don't need them anymore. But I still need some of my tools because I, you know, I'm a painter and I make all my own frames and all my own stretchers, and I do a lot of carpentry around what I do in the art world. So I still have tools and I still use them. But we have to be conscious of our stuff. And then the whole thing about speech, and I would give a long talk about speech. The most interesting thing is, I think, is that there's a Dharma talk called the 10 Unwholesome Acts of Body, Speech, and Mind. It's a very famous Dharma talk where the Buddha lays out these 10 things that are harmful, the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. The interesting thing about that talk is of those 10, 4 of them are about speech. Ah, here we go. Way more than the one-third, one-third, one-third. It's like 4 of them are just about speech. The Buddha put enormous attention on speech because, you know, speech can be extremely harmful to others. Here we are harming. We're back to not harming again. Right? It's like, oh, you know, I can speak harshly. I can speak lies. I can gossip. You know, there's lots of ways we can speak and cause harm. And all of them are unskillful, and all of them cause harm in the world, how we speak. And so it's just something that, once again, we have to, before we say something, you know, there's this great list about, is it useful, is it timely, is it said with a heart of loving kindness, you know, it's Sometimes we're about to have some big conversation with someone about something that we think is important, and we go, do I really need to say that? Is this really necessary? Is it harmful? Am I causing harm in an indirect way? Once again, it's like, oh, we have to be mindful instead of just, as is my tendency at times, to just blather. Right? Blathering, which is the fourth, there's a list of four. The fourth one is what the Buddha called useless speech. Why are you blathering? Right? I'm not saying you shouldn't talk to people. I'm not saying you don't have to engage in social conversation sometimes, because we live in a culture that's, a polite society. I'm always getting into chats with people at checkout counters and stuff like that. Just polite chatter, and it's like, you can't just sort of sit there and, oh no, I don't want to talk. It's useless speech. No, it's like it's being part of the social construct we're all part of. So we have to be careful how we look at these things. Refraining from sexual misconduct. Don't want to go into this much at all. It's a delicate topic, I understand. But I think it's really interesting to look at this in the context of the other four. Is what I'm doing causing harm? Am I only taking what is offered? Am I going to gossip about this later, about how cool I am? And then the last of them, not abusing it, intoxicants. Am I kind of a little intoxicated? Is my partner a little intoxicated? Am I taking advantage of the fact that we're both kind of intoxicated? This is a question we'd have to actually ask. If we still use intoxicants, it's an important question that we don't. In our culture, like, well, it's part of how things are, right? People get drunk and do things. Or people get high and do things. I certainly did it in my 20s. Don't even want to think about that. But it's like, that's a cult, sort of how we judge things. The interesting thing about all that is that this has nothing to do with when we talk about sexual conduct from a moral point of view. Morality has a list of things you should and shouldn't do, and depending on what church or organization you belong to, it's a bigger or smaller list. Only between a man and a woman being the classic one. Only between two people. Only, and so on and so on. There's a huge list of things that people rant about on a moral level about this very topic. The Buddha talked about none of those things ever, but to my knowledge. He always spoke of it within this context of, are you causing harm? Are you doing something that, is going to harm someone else in a variety of ways that harm might arise, right? Then, not abusing intoxicants. This is an interesting one for me, because the actual precept that's typically taught is refraining from the abuse of intoxicants. In other words, don't use them at all. Truth is, I like cold beer with Mexican food now and then, right? And so for me, I rephrase this particular precept to be not abusing intoxicants. So for me, the thing is, I have a beer. On rare occasions, I'll have a glass of wine. That's it. Because I know if I have two, I get stupid. I can feel the difference in how I'm reacting and acting and speaking. So I haven't done that in 30, 40 years maybe, when I finally realized that what's going on with intoxicants. And I just don't. But I'm not an absolutist, I guess is what I'm saying. And so for me, having a Dos Equis with a really spicy burrito is like, it's great food. and it's not at all harming anything or anybody. I'm perfectly cogent afterwards, but I really like the taste, and it goes with the food I'm eating. I'm a foodie, right? That's what can I say? Maybe I'm too much of a foodie. That's my problem. Who knows? But it's like, so all of these, the thing I'm trying to point to here is all of these virtues are things we have to think about, and what do they mean for me in my life, in my situation, and what I, how I live in the world, and how I make sure I have enough in the world, and then try and find the lines that we understand keep shifting anyway, because our life keeps changing. So we're always having to ask ourselves the questions about, is this virtuous? This is a constant practice that we have to adopt as part of our practice world, as opposed to just going, oh, yeah, I'm basically a good person, that's okay, I don't have to think about this. The fact that the Buddha expressed it as a practice, well, practice means we actually have to do something. We can't just sort of blow it off, right? Joseph Goldstein has this great line where he said, if you don't think about this as a practice, and you're just sort of like comfortable with how you are in functioning in the world, you're not looking deep enough. Practicing sila should always be a little uncomfortable. And it's like, oh, what an interesting thought. It's like, am I on the edge of how I can practice these things? When I first read that, I went, ooh. But it's an interesting way to look at it. Am I sort of going close to the where my edges are? You know, would me giving up my beer with Mexican food really be that big a problem? Question I have to ask myself from time to time. Yeah. So you see what I'm saying? This is an ongoing internal dialogue we have. And but at the same time, you don't make it into like, you know, virtue shaming. Oh me, I'm not as virtuous as I should be. I'm so bad. That's equally unwholesome. Doesn't do any good at all. So that's the second pillar. The thing about being virtuous is it's much more difficult than being moral. Morality says, here's the rules, follow these rules, you'll be okay. So it's just, it's rule following. It's often based on fear. The rules, if you don't follow the rules, you know, you're going to go to hell, you're going to, you know, be shunned by the community, you're a bad person, whatever, et cetera, you know, all the things that go on in that world. But at least it's clear, here's what the rules are. Whereas virtue is like, oh, well, there's these sort of suggestions of things you should look at, but you got to keep figuring it out for yourself all the time. It's not easy at all. Then we get to bhavana, practice. So, you know, this is usually looked at from the point of view of mindfulness and concentration, like the actual formal sitting practice that we do. And I think it's really important that we actually, as best we can, have a formal, regular sitting practice, because part of what happens in sitting practice is all those stories we tell ourselves come up, right? And the stories, often, if we really look at them, have aspects of dana and sila as part of the story. Like, I didn't get what I deserved. You know, that person wasn't generous enough to take care of me, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, we get caught up, and if we start looking at the things that arise in the mind, and see if there's some aspect of those things. That person was rotten to me, I'm going to get them. This is a story we tell ourselves. They deserve to be punished for what they did to me. Well, now you're just being the opposite of generous, and you're being the opposite of non-harming, at least in your mind. Can we look at that and go, oh, maybe that isn't a wholesome way to think about it? It's tricky. But this is what arises often, especially, and I'll say at the beginning, which includes me. I've only been practicing this form of practice for 22 years. I'm still a beginner struggling with stuff like this. So I think we're always beginners. We're always, old stories are arising, and we can start to look at them and see how much of the story has to do with and how it relates to the practices of, especially of Sila. It's a lens we can look at things through and go, oh, this idea of what I think I should do or not do or whatever. This isn't particularly a virtuous story I'm telling myself. Not in some sort of punitive wagging your finger at yourself way, but just like seeing it from that aspect, and it sort of changes the flavor of the whole story sometimes. Oh, here's another way I can look at it. So, the thing about, and the other thing about practice is practice, the formal practice, it allows us regularly to go to a place where the mind becomes at least somewhat for a little while, every day, maybe for longer periods on longer retreats, quieter and stiller. And that quiet and stillness allows us to be more mindful in our day-to-day life. I can't tell you the number of people I've talked to in the last while, people I know who practice a lot, or have practiced a lot, who've gone through some sort of health crisis of some sort. And every one of them, and I include myself in this list, actually, are so thankful for our practice. Because the practice allowed them to deal with the chaos of a health crisis and stay balanced, as opposed to getting swept away by it and freaking out. I can't tell you the number of people I talk to, with hospital chaplain one day a week. I can't tell you the number of people I talk to who are just like totally freaked out about what's going on to them as they lie there in the hospital bed. They have no way of dealing with it because they don't have a way to sort of ground themselves. A very powerful thing we have that we share. One last little tidbit. I was thinking about this. I wrote some notes on the bottom of my talk. I actually want to read something from Joseph Goldstein as well. We think of this practice as mindfulness, right? That's a translation of the word sila that we often use. The word sila gets translated as mindfulness. But another completely different translation of what's usually translated as mindfulness, sati. I should not say that, sati. Sati, which you can translate as mindfulness, is simply translated as remembering. Can we just keep remembering to practice? And remembering that what we're practicing are dana and sila, as well as sitting, walking, doing the formal practice. Can we remember that? That's what we're learning to do in a way, is just keep remembering. Because when we remember, then we can make a choice. When we don't remember, we just blindly go along through habits. So can we remember? This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And it's just an image he has here that I really like when he's talking about. This is actually a talk he gave on the three pillars of Dharma that I borrowed bits from. And he's talking about the power of really practicing all three pillars. Suppose you have a pond of water which is filled with weeds. Practicing moral restraint is like going down to the water and pushing the weeds aside to get a handful to drink. The weeds are still present, and when you take your hands away, once again they come back and cover the pond. In moments of moral behavior, the mind is pure, but as soon as we are forgetful, the defilements are there again. If you build a fence in the pond, which keeps all the weeds on the outside, water within remains clear to drink for as long as the fence is there. But the weeds are still on the outside, and if the fence is removed, the weeds come back. It's like the force of concentration in the mind. It suppresses all the defilements. The insight of wisdom is going down to the pond and pulling out the weeds. You pull one out and then another until the whole pond is clear. When removed in that way, they do not come back. Insight is a purification process. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the first lines of the Satipatthana Sutta, that's what the Buddha said. This is a practice for purifying. Insight is a purification process. When all the negativities in our mind have been looked at, examined, and finally uprooted, they do not arise again. Wisdom is the culmination of the spiritual path, which starts with the practice of generosity, virtue, and the development of concentration. From that base of purity comes penetrating insight into the nature of mind and body. By being perfectly aware in the moment, all that has been accumulated in our minds begins to surface. All the thoughts and emotions, all the ill will and greed and desire, all the lust, all the love, all the energy, all the confidence and joy, everything that is within our minds begins to be brought to the conscious level. And through the practice of mindfulness, of not clinging, not condemning, not identifying with anything, the mind becomes lighter and freer. This is the benefit of the three pillars of Dhamma, or the three aspen trunks of Dhamma, as I like to call it. This is from Mary Oliver's Book of Poems, Evidence. And in a way, this is related. I just discovered this poem, and I said, oh, I'd like to read this poem. I think it's a very beautiful poem. It's called At the Pond. One summer, I went every morning to the edge of the pond where a huddle of just-hatched geese would waddle to me and clamber up the marshy slope and over my body, peeping and staring. Such sweetness every day, which the grown ones watch for whatever reason serenely. Not there, however, but here is where the story begins. Nature has many mysteries, some of them severe. Five of the young geese grew heavy of chest and bold of wing, while the sixth waited and waited in its gauze feather, its body that would not grow. And when it was fall, and this is what I think everything is about, the way I was glad for those five and two that flew away, and the way I hold in my heart the wingless one, it had to stay. This is like having an open heart and seeing the way things are, as much as we sometimes don't want to. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.